Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everybody. This is Bonnie Kay and the Straight Wives Talk Show. This is a hard-hitting show that discusses the complexity of marriages between straight women to gay men. Each week, my guests and I discuss issues that affect over 4 million women in this country and millions more around the world who find themselves unknowingly married to a gay or bisexual man. If you do have any comments during the course of this broadcast, you can feel free to call in at area code 646-716-4893. Or if you prefer to email me, you're welcome to do that at bonkaye@aol.com. That's B-O-N-K-A-Y-E @aol.com. And before I introduce my wonderful guest for tonight, I just have a few announcements to make. First, I'm really getting ready and excited about our weekend at the end of September. It's our healing weekend, and it's for women who are coming in from all over not only the country, but from other countries as well, from the United Kingdom, from Canada, also from Australia. So we're really exciting as we converge on Philadelphia to do our healing weekend, share our stories, meet other people traveling our road, and there's nothing better than finding comfort and support in people who understand what you're feeling without ever having to open your mouth or without ever judging you. So I always say there's room for one more. We are pretty filled, but we never turn anyone away who needs to have this healing experience. So if you would like to join me, you can send me an email at bonkaye@aol.com. Also, I just want to mention that Monday nights we have our United Kingdom chat. That's at 8:30 p.m. UK time. We have women there from England, also from Ireland, Scotland, Wales. I don't even know where those two are the same place. But anyway, we have women throughout the United Kingdom. So if you would like to join me and some other incredible women, you can write to me at bonkaye@aol.com and I'll send you directions. Also, about the children, I run my children's support group Wednesday nights. That's the support group that really is most important to me right now, seeing the effects that these marriages have had on our children. And I mentioned last week I've updated my website at gayhusbands.com, and there is a tab there that says Our Children. I would like for you to read it, digest it, go back to it, until it sinks in the kinds of problems that our children have as a result of this marriage and how finding support can really make a difference for them in their future relationships as well. So if there's anything else new that I can say, oh, yeah, there is some news. I'm not going to be on next week, so I just wanted to mention that to you tonight. I will be on vacation. Yep, I am going away on vacation. So once a year, I like to go away and regroup my head and my thoughts, and next week is the week. So I will not be here next Sunday night, but once again, I will be back the following week. So if I don't talk to you next week, you'll know why, but you can listen to any one of our back episodes on Blog Talk Radio. Just go to Straight Wives Talk Show, and you can hear all the previous shows from the past. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce back my special guest, Marianne Glynn. Marianne, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Bonnie.
You could have joined us a little sooner if I sent you the correct phone number. So I really do apologize for that. This is what's happening to me now that I'm aging towards 62.
Oh,
things just don't work out the same for some odd reason.
It happens to the best of us.
I know, but why? That's what I can't figure out. But I always tell people now that I'm getting older, my brain has too many things in it. So, you know, it's overloaded.
Well, at least you can laugh about it and talk about it. You know, it's natural.
I'm hoping it is. I'd hate to think that this is just happening. But thank you so much for coming back to our show, because I know that when women listened to you a few months ago, they were really impressed about what you had to say. And, you know, you're a counselor in New Jersey, a therapist, and you work a lot with women who have post-traumatic stress. And a number of our women always write to me, they feel that they're suffering from that. So maybe you could start off by talking a little bit about what is post-traumatic stress.
Okay. I'll go through all of the clinical symptoms. I'll define it. historically, post-traumatic stress disorder has been classified as an anxiety disorder, along with things like social anxiety, general anxiety, panic attacks. But in the very newest, what's called the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, in which they categorize all the different diagnoses, the newest one, they're seeing it more as a category in and of itself. And what it is it develops after a person is exposed to a life-threatening situation, violent or accidental, or witnesses this happening to someone else, or sometimes through indirect exposure, like hearing about it. But this can be a physical situation, like violent or accidental. It can be a rape, it can be a car accident, it can be war, it can be domestic violence, things like that. Or it can be a psychologically threatening situation, like a betrayal. What the women, I'm sure, listening to this show have experienced once they find out that their husbands are gay. So I'll get back to more of how that would be affecting them. But let me just go through all of the symptoms.
Okay.
One more thing. If the exposure is prolonged, it's much more debilitating. And if a person has a history of previous trauma, it can complicate and worsen the current trauma. So I'm going to list all the different criteria. Now, this doesn't mean every one of these things have to happen, but many of them happen and people will recognize them. And it's a matter of having most of them, especially being exposed to the traumatic events. So here are some of the things that can happen. You can have intrusive thoughts about the event. You might be trying not to think about it, and you might find it filling your head all the time without you wanting it to. You might have nightmares and sleep disturbance. Or you might have triggers that cause flashbacks, and a flashback is something which I'll explain more how that works later. It's an actual reliving of the event that something triggers it to happen. Avoidance of thinking about the event and sometimes a numbing of emotion when you think about the event. Forgetting key features of the event. Persistent negative beliefs and expectations about yourself and the world afterwards, such as feeling unsafe, a feeling of dread like something bad is about to happen, or feeling of distrust. Markedly diminished interest in pre-trauma significant activities. Problems concentrating.
Keep that one more time up.
Problems concentrating.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Self-destructive or reckless behavior. An inability to experience positive emotions. Sleep and appetite can be affected. There's often an increased startle response, you know, that response you have when someone walks in the room sometimes and you don't know what you jump. But that's usually highly increased after a post-traumatic stress event. And hypervigilance, meaning that you're always kind of looking around waiting for something bad to happen or preparing for it. And a distorted sense of blame for yourself or others for having caused the event. Occasionally, there are dissociative symptoms, which not many people experience, but here they are. Depersonalization, which is feeling like you're an outside observer of yourself, and something called derealization, which is an experience of unreality, distance, or distortion, like feeling things aren't real. Okay, so those are all of the symptoms.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
When you're talking about post-traumatic stress, and I'm mm-hmm. not quite sure about this, does it specifically refer to something happening that revives an event in your mind that, well, like I'll give you an example. You know, for instance,
okay.
I'm helping you editing a story about a rape victim, and
uh-huh.
a young woman was 18 years old and severely raped, you know,
mm-hmm.
brutally raped, and... She went into it like they said, you know, her sister who's telling the story saying how she went into another world that she wasn't
mm-hmm.
able to come out of, like a childlike world after this event.
Mm-hmm.
But when with post-traumatic stress, and, you know, she calls it post-traumatic stress, like if somebody
yeah,
comes
definitely.
Near her or touches her, You know, does the reaction take you back to that time, or are you just scared?
If something triggers the actual event, you actually relive it. Let me just explain to you how trauma works. What this girl was experiencing directly after the event would be, it sounds like she went into numbing. She just kind of shut down, okay? But as time goes on, you still have a lot of these other symptoms, and you can have flashbacks forever.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, over time they should diminish, especially if you get help for it.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason that there is such a thing as a flashback, now a traumatic memory doesn't work in the brain like any other memory. You know, you can remember something that even a difficult event in your life, and it won't cause you necessarily to have a flashback reaction. But trauma is so difficult for the brain to process that memory isn't stored from it in a normal way. It's kind of, the event is kind of fragmented into sensory components and stored deep in the brain so that you can't even recall it if you wanted to.
Uh-huh.
In other words, if you wanted, you had a traumatic event and you went to a therapist, say, or talked to friends or family about it, and you actually could talk about it, you wouldn't be able to fully recall it. It's strange. You might have some memory of it, but then you could be walking along, let's say it was a car accident, you could be walking along and you think you hear a car accident that just happened. Now, that sensory input, that sound, that loud crash, will cause a flashback. It's called bottom-up hijacking. It means that actual experience in your subconscious comes flooding into your consciousness and makes you feel like you're really actually reliving it. And the fear is so intense that it feels like it's real and it's happening now. You know, there might be a little tiny part of your brain that knows you're not in a car accident right now, but what you're experiencing is exactly like it. You're in complete fight or flight in that moment. And that's why when people experience a traumatic event, even like a betrayal, you very often find yourself in a state of panic. Panic is triggered often. And panic is part of a flashback. It's when your body goes into fight or flight because there's a perceived threat. Is this making sense so far?
It does.
Yeah. Yeah, and also, you know, talk therapy is not something that really can help post-traumatic stress. You need someone who knows how to do certain techniques that actually can access the trauma where it's stored and help process it.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those things is EMDR. One of them is hypnosis. Another is sensory motor psychotherapy. And,
can you explain what that is?
Okay.
I'd really like to know.
Okay. EMDR stands for eye movement, desensitization, and reprocessing, which is a whole bunch of syllables that simply mean bilateral stimulation of the brain. Okay?
Uh-huh.
Now, you know in REM sleep, if you heard in REM sleep when you're dreaming and your eyes are going back and forth?
Right.
Have you ever seen someone's eyes under their lids go back and forth when they're dreaming?
Yes, I do. I've seen that.
And we all do that. They think that's a way that the brain processes material from the day before through the brain. And if you took your fingers right now, held up two fingers about a foot from your face, and you moved it back and forth so that your eyes have to go back and forth to see the fingers like that, that's basically, that's the technique. That's what EMDR is, basically. And it can be done through vision, it can be done through sound, it can be done through tapping, through touch. And basically it's like hitting one side of the brain, then the other side of the brain, and that helps process trauma. And it's been proven to be the most effective therapy for trauma. Hypnosis is great because in hypnosis, in a very relaxed state, and let me just clear up to people, it's not a trance, it's not something like you've seen in the show. Hypnosis is simply a deep state of relaxation so that all sensory interference is gone and you're focused on a very deep, closer to a subconscious level. And when you're in that level, your subconscious can remember things that you can't. People have been known under hypnosis to remember parts of a traumatic event that they couldn't consciously remember, for instance. And in that state, you can help heal the trauma by doing different things that help take the fear away.
Can you give me an example of that?
How
that works?
How you would
hypnotize? Is it suggestion? Is it talking them through the incident? Are they aware now of the incident?
Well, it's more kind of like therapy. I mean, there are different types of hypnosis, but this type of hypnosis would be somebody would get very relaxed. You know, you do different kind of body and mind relaxation, visualization, just to get very relaxed. And then you would ask the person to go to a particular traumatic event.
Uh-huh.
And then while they're in that state of being able to remember, they might become afraid. You know, they may or may not become afraid, but then you just help take them to a safe place and calm them and do different things like, you know, bring the event forward and make it fade away, and the next time it's not going to be as scary. And and you do different things. You create alternate endings. You can confront the perpetrator. You can do a lot of different things with both EMDR and hypnosis. That helps to heal it. You know, nothing happens instantly, although both of those things really advance healing pretty better than most things. But it takes a lot of time, obviously.
I can't imagine what some people have to suffer through in life. I mean, you know, our women are traumatized by things that happen in their marriages, and I don't mean to minimize that at all. But I can't imagine some life events where people see their families, you know, shot in front of them, or where they see their mother raped in front of them. You know, like I look at some people who come from other countries and, you know, Liberia, for instance, where I've had students who I work with who have had their hands chopped off or their mother set on fire in front of them. I mean, like, how do you ever recover from this? It's kind of like in that movie.
I don't think you completely do.
I
don't
know.
Think you'd ever completely recover from that type of thing. Not completely.
Did you ever see the movie Sophie's Choice?
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's that kind of trauma when you have to pick one of your children to live and one to die. Like, how do you live with that?
I don't think you ever completely live well with that, do you?
No, I don't. I was wondering if you knew of any methods that would make it any better, but I just don't know any.
Well, yeah, sure. These methods do help. They do work.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I think there are certain things that you may never completely get over. You can heal. Like, for instance, the death of a child is considered one of the most horrendous things. It's one of the hardest things for people to get over. It takes years and years. But, you know, maybe 10 years down the line, people will be a lot better and they'll be able to function again and go on with their life and you know, even find some happiness and meaning and all that, but there's a big part of them that will always grieve and feel the sadness and the pain. But someone who's been, for instance, sexually abused at a young age, especially by a parent, that's probably, in my opinion, well, aside from some of the things you just mentioned, really tough to get over. I've dealt with people who have, you know, come a long way and they have been able to heal and move on with their lives. But they'll never be like someone who didn't have that happen to them, I guess you might say. They'll never be as, you know.
It's true. I mean, and I don't mean ever to compare trauma.
I mean,
right. You know, I always say you can't compare one person's trauma to another person's trauma. Would you say that's true? Each person's trauma has its own individual, you know, footprint into their, you know, psyche.
Right,
and
all trauma is trauma, you know.
I know, and that's why, you know, sometimes people come to me and they say, oh, you know, I don't like to complain, you know, because I did lose both of my children. And they say, you know, you have it so much worse than I have. And I say, you can never compare pain.
Wait a minute, you did?
Yes, I lost both of my children, one at the age of 22 and one at the age of 23. Within the last,
Bonnie. I'm so sorry.
Oh, thank you. But, you know, my daughter died 11 years ago, and my son died 7 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it was very...
For you.
Very horrifying. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. I don't think there is any kind of worse experience in life than losing a child, but then I see there are really horrible situations in life, and that's why I say I never like to compare mm-hmm. traumas. You know, when I look at people who have numbers on their arms because they were in concentration camps and watched their family go up in smoke,
mm-hmm.
you know, I don't know how they survived that. You know, how do you go to bed at night with that kind of, you know, nightmare and facing you? I'd be afraid to go to sleep. So that's why I always tell women, it is, you know, there are so many things, but people seem to move on. And, you know, I use
the technique. We survive, don't we?
We survive.
We're wired to survive somehow, but not with the exact same.
Yeah, I think people survive differently. Yeah, I think people survive differently. You know, I use a technique I tell women that I work with, you know, something maybe it's not real, you know, as good as other methods, but I use something called blocking because I've learned to survive by when memory, you know, when visuals come up that are very unpleasant to me, I say stop, and I block them, and I replace them with something that's pleasant just
that's
to get me past
good.
That.
How long did it take you to be able to do that?
I think I was able to do it within, you know, a year. You know, I started support groups, you know, when my children passed away. You know, for my daughter, she died from 3.5 years of drug addiction.
Mm.
So her death, in a way, was almost a relief because I was more worried about how she was going to die than the fact that she was going to die.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I went through the highways and byways of her, you know, recovering and falling for 3.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And my greatest fear is that somebody would really do her terrible harm, you know, so at least I felt some peace of mind that she died peacefully. And my son was born with a very bad, you know, genetic disease, a very rare one, and he fought, you know, valiantly to live. He was 23, was in college becoming a teacher, and he had over 30 hospitalizations through the years, and he never thought anything could do him in, but it was a chronic disease that does do you in. And, you know, like I say, it was probably the biggest horror of my life because, you know, he was my very best friend. We went through so many things with the hospitalizations and getting him well. And also I was at that point where I had to be the one responsible for taking him off of life support. And that image was one that was my most horrifying image, I think, of all of the images of my life of having to say, pull that plug. And that one I had to learn how to block very strongly because that one would really put me down in a minute. I would become crying hysterically, feeling responsible, you know, all the things that a mother would feel towards losing a child and
of course.
Making that decision. So, you know, these are techniques that I had to learn how to survive in my own life. But I think that I keep myself very busy and focused, and that helps me a lot, too.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
I tell our women that also, that, you know, the busier you are, the less time you have to think. And maybe it's a form of avoidance, but maybe if you do, I mean, I'm not saying you can't deal with something, but maybe you have to wait till you're ready to deal with it.
Well, two things. First, I just want to say what you've been through, it certainly made you have whatever, you know, your compassion, devotion to doing something significant to help others, and I just want to honor that.
Right, well, thank you very much. It helps me just as much as it helps them, though. Trust me when I tell
you.
I'm sure.
I'll bet. That's good. I'm glad. But as far as but what you're saying about distraction, you know, we can't be in pain all the time. You know, our brains just don't. We can't live that way. So it seems to come and go. Things seem to come and go. And for post-traumatic stress disorder, it's the same thing, like those intrusive voices that, or, you know, that you can't get out of your head. Over time, little by little, you know, you get better control to the point where people might be able to do what you're doing, you know, the thought blocking. And also, it's just kind of a survive. I mean, but distraction can be a good thing. Avoidance is not a good thing.
Right.
Avoidance and never kind of going to it, you know, never really facing it. But distractions sometimes, yes, you have to do that because, you know, you're facing a lot of pain and discomfort with all of this stuff. I mean, it's so post-traumatic stress is very debilitating.
It is. And I mean, we have women in our group who are really suffering. And, you know, I wish I could just say to them, well, why don't you just take it like everybody thinks? It's funny. It's cute. It's a joke. Laugh about it. You know, these women have been brutalized, you know, in many cases, and not necessarily physically, but definitely mentally and emotionally.
Absolutely.
For many years, being made to feel as if that they've done something wrong, that their husbands don't want them, and their husbands reject them, and then they, what I call gaylight them, which is like gaslighting, but, you know, with the gay issue.
Right.
Yeah, so, you know, that movie Gaslight, where they Ingrid Bergman was made to think she's going crazy. And this is the same process these men use, and, you know, to make you think that there's something wrong with you. You must be imagining this. There's not that you're, whatever you're finding, you know, you're making a big deal out of. And, you know, there's such a abandonment also as far as emotional support in these marriages because your husband doesn't really want to be married to you anyway.
Right.
You know, he's doing it because he feels that he has to, but it's not like he really wants to be there. And these men just can't take the responsibility of being honest and saying, look, I screwed up. You know, I think our women could understand this and cope with it much better. I made a mistake. I thought I could do this. You know, I loved you enough that I wanted to do it. I just can't help who I am. And I think that we can work from that point. But that's not what happens. What happens is
that's remorse. But for some reason,
exactly.
You know, gay men who are doing this and are deliberately dishonest in creating a false self, that's just destructive. Like,
about 50% of them will never tell the truth.
Is that what normally happens? They'll never tell the
about
truth.
About 60% will never tell their wives the truth.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow.
And when I work with men, I'm
that
coming
makes
out
even worse.
I know. And then so the woman who never has closure.
Well,
you know,
two things about that. Number one, you know what that thing where you, I mean, I call that kind of a mind F, you know, where the person in the relationship is, you know, distancing. They're not really there, you know. They're, you know, and then at times they'll pull you back in. You know, either maybe sex or a gift or a good time or something, but then you feel the distancing and the rejection, and it's all so very confusing, and they keep you off balance and keep your head spinning as to what is real, and it's all very confusing, and it can make you think you're crazy. Is that what you're talking about? Yeah.
Exactly. You know, because a lot of these men, when they think they're getting caught, their behavior does change. Temporarily. And, you know, like I say, they start unraveling because they're keeping this tight secret within themselves. And they're so afraid that you're going to discover it. And a lot of these men are very controlling because they're so afraid that their secret's going to get out.
Right. That's because, can I just say something about the quote, false self that people create, which obviously is happening in this situation where gay men are getting married. I mean, that is automatically creates a destructive relationship because if someone has created a false self, whether it's a gay man in a married to a woman or a narcissistic self in which someone thinks they are flawless or needs to see themselves that way, or a sociopathic self in which someone is always in control or in power, they have this self that they put out to the world. And they do that so they never really have to face their own pain or shame or feelings of powerlessness or whatever. But it's done in kind of a complete way. Like it's kind of a decision made at some point early on, and that core part of them becomes disconnected or dissociated from that person, from what you see and what they even might think of themselves. And their main priority, and this is what makes it kind of dangerous, is that it's some of their main priority is to keep it in place, and it will be done at any cost, and that cost, of course, is mostly to you. But if you, it's like if you're in line with not having your needs met, you know, or mm-hmm. never having true emotional or sexual intimacy, or never having needs different from your partner's needs, then you're fine. But the only spouse I can think of that would fit that description would be like a Stepford wife, you know. But if you complain asking him to meet your needs as a heterosexual spouse or for intimacy or sex, which he can never do, because he's not really there and he's not really what he says he is, he's likely to scramble to maintain that false self by deflecting it onto you, you know, blaming, making you think you're crazy, playing the victim, being abusive, anger, you know, all that manipulative stuff that people do when they don't want anything, you know, you don't want, and they don't want to give you anything, basically.
And I think that as women, you know, women have this weakness, you know, and I'm not just saying our women, I'm saying women in general, you know, I would say that more than half women are really, you know, loving, caring, nurturing, fixer-uppers, like they think they can always fix everything, marriages, and they're given these men, and these broken men, you know, they think they can repair them, it's going to be a challenge, but I can do it. And then they internalize and personalize when it's not working, you know, what did I do wrong? And I always tell women, you can't fix these broken men, because even though our women are married to gay men, and that's destructive enough, you know, they're really vulnerable for other kinds of predators when they finish their marriages, because I really do believe in my heart that predators can seek out women. They have this sixth sense of knowing when you're... Right?
Yeah, absolutely. They tend to look for people who are very loyal, committed type, tolerant. It's like they feel out your tolerance.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know they're doing that, but they're feeling out what you can tolerate in them.
Mm-hmm.
They're also looking to see if you're the type who will take a lot of responsibility for everything. And always look to yourself when something isn't going right, and be able to be blamed. And not that that person is a doormat or anything, but by someone who takes a lot of responsibility. Usually, you know, often they're caretaker types or just very giving kinds of people. And in a healthy relationship, that'd be great, you know. But a person like that would also be kind of overly optimistic. And they're thinking they're in their ability to make something work that can't work.
You know, also, I think you brought up such a good point earlier. I forgot to bring it up, you know, because we kind of got lost in the conversation. You know, so many of our women who go into these marriages, you know, that end up being really destructive marriages, they've come from households where they grew up with destruction and dysfunction. You know, I think they were very... bad role modeling with their own families. And I always tell women, you have to stand up and do something different because you are the legacy to your children. If they see you are willing to put up with being, you know, put down and made to feel insignificant, then chances are the man that they're going to pick to go into their life, that's what they're going to find because they don't know any other way. They think this is how they're supposed to be. This is how my mom copes. This is how I'm going to cope. And I see this a lot, you know, and a lot of times people are just going from one bad situation into somebody who's offering them a little peace and comfort. Because I believe that, you know, women who are in abusive situations where there's domestic violence, they didn't go out on their first and second date and have the guy beat them up and say, oh, I'm in love with you. You know, that
wasn't the
beginning, right?
Oh, no.
You know, that comes over a period of time where the guy keeps feeling safer and safer.
Right.
Be able to do that and get away with it. But, you know, nobody starts off, you know, running with guys. Well, not no one, but almost no one wants to start off with somebody who's going to be terrible to them. But I think these guys know if you're coming from a vulnerable situation, that it's just a matter of time until they can get you where they want you. Is that true?
Oh, yeah. Often a vulnerable situation. Not always. I shouldn't say that. I think there's always some type of vulnerability. You know, a lot of times women might come from a home where maybe, you know, there was their needs weren't being met and they were used to that, or there was abuse, or there was chaos and they were trying to, you know, make everybody be a peacemaker. Or maybe, you know, they could have a different type of traumatic background, like maybe they had a rape at some point in their life, or maybe they just had the breakup of a really painfully bad relationship and they were vulnerable at that point. So, you know, I think pretty much any kind of woman could get into this situation. But I think, of course, the caretaker types are more targeted, it seems.
Well, I think it's ironic.
Do you think so?
When we look at our women who are part of our support network, it's really interesting that when we get together, like with our healing weekends, I would say that 80% of the women are in the healing helping profession. They're either teachers, doctors, nurses, therapists, counselors, mental health workers, you know, working with child services. They're the fixer-uppers of the world. And I think that broken men gravitate towards women who are like this because they feel a safety net, you know, that you're going to help fix, or that if you can't fix, they'll accept you.
Do you agree with me? Yeah, I didn't really think of it quite like that, that they're gravitating toward you because you can help fix them, but I'm sure that, that it would be part of it, sure.
Well, even if, but then if you can't fix, they feel safe enough that even if it doesn't work out, you're understanding enough and you're a helper, so you're not going to abandon them and do anything bad to them.
Yes, you're not going to abandon them. Exactly, they're counting on that.
Exactly.
Yep. And you're going to take probably a lot of responsibility and just keep trying to make it, keep it going. Yeah.
I know.
And somehow
they
have radar.
Yeah, and in our case, Gator, you know, they have Gator to check us out. They know that we'll accept it again. You know, and try to just fix it. But, you know, and if we can't, then we're not going to be angry over it because, you know, we all have gay friends when we get married to them and we're all very pro-gay. And they know that. So they don't feel that will definitely be an issue. You know, one of the things that maybe you can give some advice to our women, because this is always a problem that comes up, finding the right therapist. Because we have women who go into therapy and they're told all kinds of bad information. You know, like, they're, like, for instance, I know that in most relationships it takes two to make a relationship. But not in these relationships. It only takes one. Because you're not even living your real life with somebody who's living a lie and changing who you are because you're just trying to survive that game. And, you know, so you don't emotionally grow and nurture and become who you want to be. I know in my marriage I just became a full-time detective. I didn't have time to go to school. I didn't have time to grow. Anytime I wanted to get out of the control of my ex-husband, he was very controlling because he was so afraid the secret would come out. So, you know,
right.
I was on guard all the time playing detective, going, you know, that, I should have started the detective agency, if anything. And a lot of our women are like, but I tell women
that's not, you know, that's survival mode. That's not thriving. You know, that's not being in a vital marriage at all. It takes two people to make or save a marriage if two people are... Number one, are able and willing to be honest with themselves and each other.
Exactly.
Okay. In that case, yes, it takes two people. But and all marriages have problems. You know, all marriages have points of stress where the power struggle takes over, and everyone gets frustrated with each other, and you don't know what to do. But that doesn't mean that it's going to fall apart. It means that if those two people are honest enough to know who they are, you know, to know what their feelings are, and be able to communicate these things with each other, you can work through these things. That's what you do with these. You bring these childhood wounds and dysfunctional behaviors into the marriage. Everybody does. But if you can look at yourself and talk to each other about these things, creating safety for each other to speak openly, they can be worked through. And you can always get the help of a therapist or a marriage enrichment and all that. But if you don't have two people present in a marriage, then no. Then you don't have one person. Like, for instance, if one person has exited, by exited I mean like has an addiction, is cheating, abusing the spouse, that person is not present in the marriage. Those behaviors, if they're not able to be corrected, have already broke the marriage all by itself without any help from the other partner. So it's never the other partner's fault that someone has made a choice to do those things. There might be stress in the marriage that made the person more vulnerable to become addicted or to cheat or abuse or whatever, but the choice to do it is theirs and only theirs. It came from a moment in time when that person perceived that behavior as an out for them somehow. Now, a similar exit would occur, a similar exiting would be in a marriage where a person comes into the marriage with a false self, like in the case of a gay husband or a narcissist or sociopath. So I'm not talking about how we put our best selves forward early on, or some of the denials or masks that we all might have to an extent. I'm talking about a person who has really, like, exited from who they are, like the core of the person has been cut off or shut down. And so they're not completely there in the marriage, and they never fully engage. So emotional intimacy just isn't possible. In the work of marriage, being present, honest communication, discovering and healing of childhood wounds and conflicts, sexual intimacy, none of that can happen. And it's not the fault of the spouse who's present. It's just an impossible situation.
I think a lot of women see, I'm not talking about with their gay husbands, but a lot of women in other relationships, you know, see these signs going in, but they're so convinced with the right love and with the right affection and nurturing, he can get over this. And I say to women, you know, you can't see these guys. They are too broken for you to fix. I mean, if they haven't been fixed by the time they meet you, you know, they're going to fall into the safety net of living with you and feeling even more comfortable. And I know that because I had a husband prior to, you know, my gay husband who had obsessive compulsive, you know, behavior. And he was on his very best behavior when he was just courting me or we were going together. And I knew there were oddities that he had. But, you know, like people would say, oh, everybody has, you know, what they call shtick, or everybody has some kind of, you know, little stuff. And, you know, you can learn to overlook it. You know, he can love you enough, he'll change it. You can't let these little things hit you. And, you know, he hid a lot of them really well because he loved me and wanted to marry me. But after we were married, then all of a sudden new ones started popping up because he was hiding them down so much before we got married. And there was no way to fix this. You know, I sent him for therapy, and he went because I told him if he wouldn't go, I was going to leave him. But, you know, 6 months later with no progress at all, I said to the doctor, why is there no progress here? You know, he's still doing the same stuff. And he said, well, he's only coming here because you threatened him. He doesn't want to change. And, you know, that's what the whole thing is. A lot of these guys don't want to change. You know, they're not looking for personal growth with you. They're looking for you to accept the way they are.
Exactly.
So if you see red flags before you get involved with somebody, those red flags aren't going to turn blue. They're going to stay red.
You know what people do, I think especially women, they decide early on that this is a good guy for them, and then they become blind to all the red flags.
Isn't that true? I think that's how women are.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm just saying that when they come out of these marriages after coming from a disaster, you know, and they are vulnerable, I tell them, like, it's like any other kind of addiction would tell them, like AA or NA, you know, you have to give yourself a minimum of a year to get to know who you are. Because
whoever you are
isn't who you are anymore. You have to find yourself again, because if you don't...
I totally agree with that. You lost yourself, number one. You have to grieve, number two, and deal with the trauma of what happened. And then you have to and you have to heal. And then you can't, otherwise you'll end up in the same situation. Absolutely.
Marianne, can you give our women some good tips for self-esteem building? Because, you know, I work with some women who, you would see them on television, they're that beautiful, and they're that smart, you know, externally they look good, internally they are good, inside they feel like crap. You know, mm-hmm. they have no sense of self-esteem, and I do some stuff with them, but what do you suggest for building your self-esteem?
Well, this is going to sound weird, but
mm-hmm.
self-esteem has a lot to do with just being able to be still in yourself. By
mm-hmm.
still, I mean just to be able to be kind of inside your body and mind, to have mindfulness. And you can do that through mindfulness exercises. You can do that through things like yoga, meditation, relaxation, things that are soothing and grounding. I have a whole list of things. If you want, I could send them to you if it would be. I didn't send you that last time, did I? A handout of.
No, well, I'd rather you not send it to me. I'd rather you come back again. See, I'm going to put
okay.
you in. And make
okay.
you go through them. That would be great.
Mm-hmm.
But
okay,
would you do that?
Things that make you comfortable inside your body by mindfulness. I mean, to learn how to be still inside, and in that way, you get in touch with your core self. You build your sense of self. That to me seems to be the most profound thing that seems to help, and it's a hard thing for people to do. Would I be able to do a 1 minute exercise with all your listeners right now?
Absolutely.
Thank you for a one-minute exercise. Okay, so it's like a mindfulness. This is what I mean by it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, everybody just close your eyes and just sit, you know, with your feet on the floor, I guess, just sit in a comfortable position. And first I want you to focus on the thoughts in your head. Just notice what thoughts are going around in your head. Doesn't matter what they are. Don't judge them. Just acknowledge them with a thought like, well, this is just the way it is right now. And now keeping your eyes closed, bring your focus to your breathing. Put all your attention on your breath. On the breathing in and the breathing out, wherever you find your breath. You can breathe deeply or you can just breathe naturally. But put all of your attention on just the breathing in and the breathing out, and just leave it there for a few moments. And now take your attention and put it in your body. Just go through your body. Keeping your eyes closed, still go through your body and just notice any sensations that might be in your body anywhere. Notice what your body feels like. Notice what your feet feel like on the floor. Notice what it feels like to be in your body right now. And just stay in that awareness for a moment. And when you're ready, you can open your eyes. So that's an example of just being inside of yourself, of mindfulness.
I feel better already.
Yeah, it only took a minute.
I know, it's in a very relaxed state, to be honest with you.
Uh-huh.
That's really great. I think I'll have to get a tape.
I'm sorry, we keep talking at the same time. Go ahead.
I was just saying I felt really relaxed. You know, if you could let mm-hmm. yourself go into that, it's almost like a hypnotic state, right?
Yeah. Yes, I would say so. You go very inward. So
if you do something
every day that's very, you know, in order to change the brain, there's been a lot of science lately on the brain because they've been able to have all these scanners and things where they can tell how things work better in the brain. And one of the things that they find to change the brain, in other words, to heal it, to give yourself more positive beliefs about yourself, for instance, it takes what's called focused attention. In other words, you have to do stuff every day in order to counteract what's there, even if you're going to therapy. Therapy once a week is not going to do anything much unless you're practicing stuff every day. EMDR and hypnosis aside. you have to focus attention on, let's just say you pick two things a day to work on. Let's say one might be 10 minutes of stillness or meditation or a guided meditation. You know, you can go to YouTube. There's millions of them if that works better for you. Or maybe do some yoga stretches or any kind of stretches. Or maybe do some journaling. Something that just connects you to yourself, your emotion, and to your body. And when you're connected to yourself, you're building your sense of self. When you acknowledge what you feel, good or bad or whatever, you're validating yourself. And these might be things that you didn't get enough of growing up, perhaps. You might know, and when you pay attention to yourself, you might notice what goes on inside of you a lot, because most of the time we're not that focused and aware of it. I had a client who was becoming aware of negative thoughts she had when she was trying to go through this course of testing, and it was really driving her crazy. And so she started really becoming mindful and paying attention to it. And she came back a couple weeks later and just said, "Oh my God, I can't believe how many negative thoughts are in my head, like 90% of the time." and that's okay. The important thing is to notice that they're there when you have awareness of what's going on inside of you, little by little. You find the detachment to put something else there, you know, put a different belief, in your head, or a different feeling in your body when you're having a bad feeling, especially if you're having a flashback type situation or anxiety or panic related to what's going on. It's very important to learn how to soothe that negative feeling.
I think that's great advice, because, you know, in our chat room earlier tonight, that was an issue coming up. One of our support group members emailed me a question for you.
Okay.
He said, "Can your guests address the issue of the false self as being representative of emotional or mental instability? I'm looking for a way to psychologically describe my husband's deceit, compartmentalization, as either emotional or mental instability. And your guests go so far as to make that connection."
What was that last line?
Somebody's living a false life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these gay men are, by not telling you the truth. I mean, you have the proof.
Right.
You know, you have their gay porno, you have their letters, you have pictures, but they're
right.
still telling you that, you know, denying it. So is this being representative of emotional or mental instability?
Well, yeah. I don't know. It might not be mental illness, instability that way, but it's definitely a personality problem. You know, a false self is a personality. Well, it's more termed as a personality disorder. It's a very deeply ingrained defense system that almost never, you know, the person is not willing to break. So you might try to tell them what you know or tell them what you think, and they deny it, even with evidence in front of their own face. And they may never really admit anything to you, because that their mission is to see themselves in a particular way and never blame themselves, never take responsibility, never have remorse. And that's very frustrating for people, because you feel like, well, how can I get closure? How can I go on when I can't get this person to validate my experience? Well, you're not going to get them to validate your experience, unfortunately. You've got to validate your own experience.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think her concern, and maybe address this, is that, let's say you have children and it comes to court about, you know, custody. You know, it's... Woman feels that, you know, her ex-husband, how good of an influence can he be when he continues to live this lie and he can't be honest, you know, that there is a character flaw, but how does that affect his raising of children?
Oh, well, that's very variable. Very variable. It's not usually a good situation. You know, when you have a person who can never really be honest with themselves and always have to remain, you know, keep this false self and keep it in control, what if the kids challenge it? What is he going to do to that, you know? Is he going to abuse them or yell at them or distance from them or whatever? That's not often a good thing. It's not always that way, though. Some guys can have these personality disturbances and be good enough fathers, you know, not abusive, offensive enough. It can happen. It's very bad. In the courts, though, the courts don't recognize any of that stuff. They only recognize out-and-out abuse. Or like drug addiction or alcoholism or something like that. I mean, they're going to let a kid go with a parent unless there's some big thing like that. And I've had a lot of men and women be really hurt by the court system regarding that because they know that these kids are being exposed to things that they shouldn't be.
Exactly.
And there's nothing they can really do about it.
I know, and I think that's what's so hard on our mothers, you know, in our group. You know, they have young children who are being exposed to things that are really not the right thing to expose children to, and, you know, or their husbands just don't have that connection with the children, or they're trying to use it as a power struggle, or, you know, a way to punish the mother. Like, they're really not that interested in their kids anyway. They never were, but they just don't want to have the satisfaction of beating them. So I see these really bad, you know, as far as that's not to say that all gay men are bad fathers. I mean, a lot of them are wonderful fathers. Mm-hmm. But the ones who are dishonest or the ones that, you know, are controlling or sociopaths, you know, it's really difficult.
Yeah, that's what I see mostly, too. Most of the time I see the other partner, the destructive partner, allying with one or more of the kids against the spouse. Using the kids to be vindictive, and they'll often end up that kid will be brainwashed and against that other parent, and that's of course terrible, terrible thing to do to the kid. Turn them against their other parent, who they need.
But they don't even have a conscience, so, you know, to them it's a game. You know, they're just trying to alienate the child from the parent. And I know that with the kids that come from these marriages, you know, I've been doing more and more work with them. I run a support group for them now. And there's so many issues that we did not even think about. You know, when you're going through this struggle, you know, you're hurting, and that's the primary source. You know, that doesn't negate the fact you can't be a good mother, you know, because you love your children. Do the right thing, but I've learned in the last 6 months since running the support group online that these kids have real issues that they're dealing with, including trying to be, you know, they had to be the keeper of the secret. You know, a lot of them found out that their dads were gay by the computer, so all the gay porno and emails. And what are they supposed to do with that? You know, do they tell their mom? Do they tell her, and then the family's going to break up, then their mom's going to be miserable, or the fathers know that, you know, they confront their fathers, and their fathers tell them, well, don't tell your mom. If you tell your mom, you know, it's going to break up the family. You know, the stories are unbelievable.
Oh, boy. Yeah, that's horrible. It's a little bit like sexual abuse, a little bit, you know, like it's a secret, you can't tell anyone, or it's going to be your fault.
Exactly.
You know,
and then the fact that they're living with their own issues of sexuality. If my dad's you know, they have to deal with that. They have to deal with relationships, you know, how their relationships. I mean, the women who are part of this group all have issues with trusting men because they say, my dad could do this. You know, my mom loved him so much and he was, you know, our father. You know, well, how do I think this isn't going to happen to me? You know, and then you start. Issues. So on my website now under Our Children, you know, there's a whole list of the issues that the kids are talking about as, you know, young adults, and it's affecting their relationships.
I'm sure it is.
Yeah, it is. And that's, you know, the sad part. And that's why when they're younger and you go to court and, you know, these are kids who already grew up, but, you know, and the marriages were intact. they've gotten out later. But for the ones who are now growing up and they have little kids and their husbands are lying about it, or they're having, you know, involved with partners who, you know, they're there today, gone tomorrow, bringing the kids and exposing them to this. I mean, you know, it's very traumatizing.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, I'd like to learn more about that. Have you written a book?
Which?
Are you writing a book on that, the children?
I'm starting to write more and more on it. I just have a new book coming out. It'll be out next week. It's called Gay Husbands. Called Gay Husbands Say the Darndest Things. And it's a compilation of things that gay husbands tell their wives to throw them off track. And, you know, I'll be talking about it more when I come back, but that book will be available in 2 weeks, you know, in all the Barnes and Noble, Amazon kinds of outlets. But, yeah, on the children,
I really
want more and more research on this because I can see this having really ripples of effects that we as parents never really recognize. And so
I mean, if a kid grows up in a situation where there is deceit, even if this deceit isn't spoken about, kids somehow know that that person isn't quite there. You know what I'm saying? The kids can somehow, their experience of that household, of that caretaker, is going to, you know, resonate in their subconscious, and somehow it's going to be in, when they go look for a partner, that's going to be in there. That's what's going to be familiar to them. So, and it might not be a gay partner, but it might be some other kind of deceptive thing going on, you know. It's got to affect them.
Yes, because a lot of these fathers are very detached from their children because they're not making that emotional connection. And that's not to say they...
And then the kids have to deal with the betrayal, too. And everything
betrayal.
Else.
So there's a lot of issues they're, you know, dealing with. So this is something I'm studying more and more and, you know, trying to reach out to more and more young people because I see this through the group we have now, how many problems they are having. So
I'm sure.
The whole new part of this that none of us really knew about. You know, there's a lot of groups. Yeah, there's a great Gay Fathers Project where everybody's writing in, you know, for pro-gay parents, pro-gay marriage. And, you know, I think it's great you have to feel proud of your parents, but that doesn't stop all the issues that you're having as their child.
No, that's a different thing anyway. If both parents are gay, it's a different thing anyway, you know.
Right, or even if these are girls who found out their dads were gay and they want gay rights. And, you know, I think that's really great, but that's not really hitting on the issues that kids are affected by. I'll just read you a couple of them before we go. One is establishing trust in their own relationships or future relationships with their partners due to ongoing secrets and lies while growing up. Low self-esteem because some of them were keepers of the secret, living with guilt and feeling blame. Questioning their own sexual identity coming from a gay parent and whether or not this is passed down. Anxiety due to family problems between parents and situations based on daily abandonment issues when the gay person moves to his new life, acceptance of their father's life, new life and partners, fear of rejection in their relationships or marriages as the news comes out, fear of future generations and the gay gene possibility, questioning how many family problems that impacted their thinking was due to their gay father's perceptions and how much of it was really reality-based. So,
It's a disaster.
It's a disaster, exactly.
Yeah.
So these are things that, you know, really are important to me as we're coming in the upcoming year. And also I just want you to know that my new campaign that I've written about, you know, moving forward, I have a committee that's really helping me, starting a new thing called His Fault Divorce. And, you know, I'll be having a website put up, you know, in the fall. You know, I took the domain name His Fault Divorce because I really do believe that there are men who need to pay for these divorces because there's no such thing as no fault. It was their fault.
There's a movement like that in New Jersey going on, too, you know, about alimony. You know, and not only alimony, but, you know, whether or not the a certain parent is really right to have those children shared custody.
There's so many issues.
Mm-hmm. You know, I have a client who's paying alimony to her abuser.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that insane?
Right.
And we have the same thing here. We have men who go after alimony. You know,
after all that.
After all that, and now they want the women to keep paying for it. So, you know, there are states that have fault divorce, but a lot of the problem is the fault isn't, you know, they'll talk about adultery, but adultery doesn't count if it's, you know, two men. So there's a lot of legal things that need to be changed, and I do believe
that's crazy.
Divorce is right.
Yeah.
I know. So this is what we're working on.
No, that's great. That's great. I would definitely like to, you know, be involved in that.
Well, that's great. So I'll be sending you more on that.
Keep my eyes open. Okay.
So, Marianne,
I want to tell you, too, that I have a website for the group that I run that'll be coming out
in 2 days. Yeah, I want to talk about
how. And I'll send you a link.
Okay, that's great. And plus, you're on our, you know, website under resources, you know, for our women. You can check, you know, just click into Marianne, you know, website there. And is that the best way people, what's the best way people should get in touch with you?
Email.
Okay, and you can get that on gayhugs.com. You can go right over to the link for Marianne and email her that way.
Mm-hmm.
And also, let's talk a little about your group that you run.
Yeah, I've been running a group. I just call it Partners in Destructive Relationships, so it can cover all kinds of destructive relationships. I started it about, 4 months ago in response to just having so many people in these types of situations. And I thought, these people need support. And I have this core group, and so far it's been only my clients. And I've been trying to think of a way to expand it and make it known to the general public, so I decided to put a website up. So it should be up this week. We're meeting the first and third Thursdays starting in September. And basically it's an hour, usually, unless it's a lot of people, so everybody gets a chance to talk and use it. And people support each other. It's really great.
I think it's great to them.
They really appreciate the time and the ability to support each other.
And I just want to
very
say
necessary.
That.
And plus, a group does not happen alone. Healing happens interactively, whether it's with a therapist, other people who support you, and a group can just be part of that. But nobody heals alone. It just can't happen. The brain, we're not wired that way. We need other people to help us heal.
That's what I tell women. You can't do this on your own. You can't take this journey by yourself. You know, there's always support out there, and it's really important to find it. You know, we have chat rooms, we have gatherings, we have our healing weekend coming up, we have radio show, my newsletters, you know, that women, I can set them up with pain pals, one-on-one, you know, so there's plenty of support available, but to think you can do this alone is not going to work. I do want to say this, one of our members last time, one of our support group women started with you, she said she couldn't continue because of personal circumstances. But she said that you were just an amazing, she's had it like 3 times, you know, counselor.
I learned so much.
So if you're in New Jersey and you want to get involved or not too far from New Jersey, you know, Marianne's groups can really make a difference for you, and Marianne one-on-one can make a total difference from you. Marianne, do you do any other kind of, other than face-to-face, do you do Skype counseling too?
I have not, but I'd be willing to do that. On the website, I am going to set up an online support group as well. I'll let you know when that's up and running. Skyping, though, that's an idea, yes. I believe I can do that. I'm just thinking about the insurance ethical issues. That can be done. That can be done.
Yeah, because a lot of
insurances go across state lines, so it doesn't matter.
No, because a lot of the, you know, the few therapists that I recommend on my link, you know, other than you, they are doing Skyping.
And
you know, I have your email address here on my website. I'm looking at it now. And it's under Coaching and Therapy Help for Women. And you'll see Marianne's name there with her email address. You can just click into it and it will bring you to an email. And I know that a lot of people listen during the week. They're not listening live. But, you know, you can always email you know, Marianne anytime at magpie88@yahoo.com. You'll see her email address on my site, or you can always write to me and get it that way. So, Marianne, I want to thank you so much for, you know, staying with us and, you know, becoming our guest again. And I hate to push you in a corner, but I'm hoping you'll come back again.
Sure, I'd be happy to.
You know, you're such a great resource, so I'll look forward to maybe having you in, you know, October or November, and I'll drop
Absolutely.
You a note. And, you know, we're both part of Donna Anderson's network, and
mm-hmm.
very supportive of Donna's work and what she does to alert people to sociopaths. And I was so impressed with what you have to write, and you'll read, you know, you can go to Marianne's website and read her beautiful stuff also. But I think that this whole network, you know, working with Donna is looking to stop women from making mistakes that are really going to affect
yes.
them time, right?
Yes, and to help them get out of the bad places that they may find themselves in.
Yes, there's always hope.
Yeah.
You never have to feel that there's no hope. And if you're even listening to this show, you know there's hope, or you wouldn't
mm-hmm.
be listening. Just
yes.
taking one at a time, and we're here for that support. So, Marianne,
That's
I want
right.
to thank you so much for coming back, and I'll look forward to having you as a guest again in the fall. I'll be in touch.
Thank you, Bonnie. It's great being
All
there.
All right, and you have a wonderful
okay.
week.
Thank
All
you.
Right,
you have a great vacation.
Thank you. I plan to.
Okay,
All
take
right,
care.
Take, right, bye-bye.
Good night, everyone. Bye.
Good night. And I just want to say to our listeners, it's wonderful that I can bring you really great guests like this who are willing to give up their time. And when you need help, these are the women you need to see. You know, you're always asking me about therapists, who should I go to? This comes up every week on our chat rooms. Even though we don't have these women necessarily in your neighborhood, they do phone counseling. Some of them are doing Skyping. You know, we have Marianne, Kimberly Brooks, of course, Francine Barbetta, you know, and Suzette Hilton. Suzette, who's with me every month now. She does coaching for minority women, and she's just a great coach in general. So take advantage, Dr. Brian Hooper. We all love the doctor in the house. He's our guy. You know, he does wonderful counseling, too. And we have a new resource for men who's on my website, John Ballou. And so there's lots of resources for people. You need to just get a resource and go with it. So to my listeners, I'll be missing you all next week. And, you know, I'll be away. Having, you know, time to regroup and do some more thinking. As some of you know, I've been doing some really, a lot of thinking, as you can read from my recent newsletters. If you're not getting my newsletters, please write to me at bonkay@aol.com. That's bonkay@aol.com, and I'll make sure that you're on my newsletter list. Also, I have the support chat 3 times a week here in the United States and North America and Canada. We have women from Canada and from the United States, and I have my UK chat tomorrow night at 8:30 UK time. If you'd like to join me there, that's fine too. Whatever it takes, whatever support you need, I'm happy to set you up with other women, you know, to be your pain pal through this journey. Don't ever feel you have to do it alone. And so now I'd like to close the program with a song. Let's see if this song will come up. It's not the right version, but...
Now nothing's impossible. I have found for when my chin is on the ground, I pick myself up, dust myself off, and start all over again. Don't lose your confidence if you slip. Be grateful for a pleasant trip and pick yourself up, dust off, start over again. Work like a soul inspired until the battle of the day is won. You may be sick and tired, but you'll be a man, my son. Will you remember the famous men who had to fall to rise again? So take a deep breath, pick yourself up, start all over again.
And that's the message for tonight. Pick yourself up, dust yourself off, and start all over again. I love my listeners. Thank you for being so supportive to me. I'll be missing you next week, but I'll be back soon. So enjoy some of the old shows in the archives. Go to Block Talk Radio, put in Straight Wives Talk Show, Take a show you didn't have time to hear. Love to you all. Hope is on the way, and I'm looking forward to being back, but really looking forward to going away. Take care and have a wonderful week. Bye-bye.